It seems like it's been forever, doesn't it? Goodness. And so now, you know, I have an ungodly amount of stuff in my head trying to push its way through. Say this, say this, say this. I'm like, I'm not saying none of that. So I'm trying to manage my pushing away and connecting all of that at the same time. All this excitement I have because I've missed you so much. So I'm trying to have this sense of calmness at the same time. I always get so excited when I'm starting on something, especially something I like. And I love talking about aversion. But I want to talk a little bit about the hindrances first, because, you know, going on a long retreat, going on a retreat period, if you're a teacher, you go on a retreat, you always want to go back and kind of wipe out all the talks you gave before, because you have this whole new understanding. And if you go on a long retreat, it's even worse. It really changes your understanding. So this long retreat I've been on, it was 3 months of dealing with the hindrances, just in a way that I'd never really experienced it before. The hindrances, I hope we all get used to the fact that they're always with us. They're not going anywhere. I mean, we think that there's somehow we're gonna get past all the hindrances, but all we really do is get connected to them on subtler and subtler and subtler levels, but they're always kind of there. And so when you're on a retreat, it's just part of life. That's just part of being on retreat, is somehow or another having a relationship with the hindrances. Being on a 3-month retreat, that's a whole nother level of relationship with the hindrances. And so And for me, my go-to hindrance is aversion. It's the place I always go to whenever something isn't quite, I want to say it's not quite right, but really, it's the first noble truth. Whenever I have this suffering, aversion is the way I'm going to respond to it. So some people, whenever they have that suffering, greed is the way they're going to respond to it. Some people, they're just going to check out, dull kind of, I'm through, like disassociate from it. And for some people, it's restlessness, this kind of edgy, worrying about, running around, excess energy. And for some people, it's confusion. That's our go-to energy. That's what these hindrances are, or a way that we're going to talk about it. There's this kind of go-to energy that we have with them. But what I learned on this retreat is that go-to energy is really, it's really just turning down the street. You haven't even got to the house. Let's just say it's not even turning down the street. It's more like deciding to get in your car to go somewhere. But you haven't gone anywhere. You just are noticing this kind of easy energy. So whatever that go-to hindrance is for you, whatever it is, that is kind of like the clue to pay attention. There's a quote I have here from Ram Dass that I like. He says that a feeling of aversion or attachment towards something is your clue that there's some work to be done. That's what it is. It's like a clue. It's not the end of the game. It is the beginning, the start of this possibility for enlightenment, this possibility for awakening. And without the hindrances, there's no awakening. It's not coming. So it's almost as if, I don't really like that word hindrance that we call it, because it has this it kind of sets us up in English to begin to think that whatever this is something that's in the way and I got to get rid of it. And there is a bit of that that we're going to talk about. But the English understanding of getting rid of a hindrance is very different, I think, than the practice and the way that the Buddha talked about the abandonment of hindrances, which is a different understanding, different relationship. So the way I thought I would do this month is I want to give a talk generally about the hindrances and a little bit about the aversion. I just want to talk a little bit more about how to deal with hindrances, how to hold them. And I know Tim, I listened to his talks, and I know he talked about this general understanding of the hindrances. So I'm not trying to just, you know, wipe all that out. I just want to add a little bit more to it. Because if we're going to work with this for 5 months, and truly like say, okay, I'm going to take this on and I'm going to start looking at these hindrances, then we have to hold them in a much broader framework, something almost like akin to a gift that somebody's giving you and you're going to, you know, look and gaze upon that gift. So I want to just expand out what he was talking about a little bit more and then talk a little bit about aversion generally. And then next week, instead of having a discussion, I'd like to continue talking with a talk on the hindrances, the emotional side of the hindrances. Because there's a lot, I mean, the emotional side of aversion. Because there's a lot of emotional energy that shows up with aversion that if we just sort of look at aversion as a pushing away without understanding the emotional context behind it, then we're not really paying attention to what's actually going on. There is a mind-body kind of symbiotic relationship that's going on with a present moment, whatever that moment is. And so we're going to try to see what the emotional content is behind it. And some of these emotional some of the emotions we have, we don't necessarily think of it as aversion. Like when we're having grief or fear or, you know, just things that seem unrelated to aversion, it seems more related to the event or whatever's causing that sadness or that grief to arise. That's where the grief is coming from. But there's actually an aversion that's connected to it. And I also want us to look at anger in a different way. There's a way in which we, as practitioners, judge or talk about anger that I'm hoping next week we could talk about it a little differently, because it's not really our enemy as much as we talk about it that way. So that's the emotional side. And then on the third week, we'd have a discussion for both of those. Instead of, I'll do a little summary of both of them, and then we'll have a discussion. And the reason why I'm kind of doing it this way is because on the fourth week, I won't be here, Tim won't be here, and we're going to have something else going on that we're going to talk about at the end of the evening. But so anyway, that's the way I was hoping we could plan this month out and deal with kind of practice with aversion in a maybe in a subtler way, or I shouldn't say subtler, a fuller way to talk about it. So a little bit about my retreat, because we're going to talk about it with the aversion, but in my retreat, I'd say it was the second day. Maybe it was the third day. Third day of 12 weeks. 89 days. This is day three. I go in to have this conversation with my teacher. I don't know him. He don't know me. We're just going to chat. 15 minutes, that's all it is. And he says, Tuareg, I think I started out by saying something like, oh, I'm noticing how I kept trying to force my practice to go a certain way and it's not working, but I'm okay. I got it. I'm settled and it was really good. And he said, I'm glad you saw that. Better you saw it than me. Better you tell yourself than me telling you. I've been noticing some striving. Oh my God. When he said he had noticed some striving, the striving person I am set in motion this idea that everybody in that room, all 100 people, could see me striving. So I am not going to do any striving. I am not going to strive. That's the whole point. So I'm going to strive to not strive. That is exactly what I'm going to do. It's not going to happen. So I'm sitting here trying not to strive. But at the same time, you know, you want to have some experience in your practice of peace and you just want some enlightened moment. But I'm not going to strive for it. I'm just going to sit here and it's just going to come. So by, I'd say 5 days in, I'm having some difficulties because this level of practice that I'm used to is not coming. And I think it's because I'm not striving. Keep that. That's a little note there. I'm not striving. So I'm not doing something right. And at the end of the week, I see him the second time, this teacher. So you have two teachers. I see my other teacher and, you know, I'm like, yeah, I'm doing okay. It's a little different, but that's okay. I'm doing okay. I'm doing okay. That's all that matters. I'm doing okay. 12 weeks. This is just the beginning. So I don't know how many of you have a ringing in your ear, but the stiller I get, the louder this ringing gets. But you can get still to the point where that ringing goes away. And when it goes away, then I'm like, oh, we're golden. It's like a completely different world. So that's what I have used as my gauge for stillness for at least 10 years. That ringing, whatever that sound is that Semedo calls the sound of silence, goes away. We're okay. Everything's right as rain. We're all good. So I go into my second meeting with my teacher. It's about a week in. I said, everything's going good. Sound's almost gone. Everything is settling. Finally feeling okay. I'm not striving. Everything's going okay. I said, I think probably a couple days that sound will be gone. He goes, maybe not. Maybe not. Oh, no. It's going to be gone. I'm not even worried about that. He said, it might be here the whole 12 weeks, Tuareg. I'm like, don't say that. It's not going to happen. Oh my God, it has been 2 months since that retreat and I still have that sound. It's not going anywhere anymore. But what happened in that moment, I don't know if you can see it. I didn't understand it at the time. But in that moment, you can imagine heaven is the sound being gone, hell is the sound staying. So from then on, my practice was never about practicing. It was about how am I going to get this sound to go away? How am I going to prove he's wrong? And how am I going to make this be the way I should have my sit? I mean, it should be the way it's been for 10 years. That moment in time created a whirlwind of difficulty that I probably spent a good, 6 weeks in. It took about 6 weeks before I finally understood what was happening. That's the thing about these hindrances. That's why it's so important to kind of understand the hindrances in this broader container, because we don't know we're in the hindrance when we're in it. So to have this conversation about it as if, oh, look there, there's a hindrance, there's a hindrance, there's a hindrance, as if we would know, that's the difficulty, because I know aversion. And I didn't know that I was in aversion when I was in it. The way I found out that I was in aversion was really doubt. I started having so much doubt about my ability to practice and what I was doing because it wasn't working, that doubt began to gnaw at me, and then I could see that I was caught in this like hindrance. So the difficulty with trying to have a conversation about aversion is that you look for aversion and say, oh, I don't have any aversion, I'm good. I thought, I'm doing good, I'm not striving, everything's great. I didn't even see that secretly, yes I am. So when we start talking about the hindrances, this framing of them in this very kind of non-personal thing becomes very important. Whatever hindrance you're working with is not about you. It's from the desire aspect, this grasping or wanting or the aversion, which we always tag on as being somehow the bad seed. It's actually the same thing, meaning that you can't have any aversion unless you have some desire. You have to want something to not want whatever's there. And you can't have desire without having aversion, because you have to want something that's not there, and you're averse to whatever the present moment is without whatever. You're wanting something against the reality that it's not there. So this desire and aversion, it's sort of always intersected together. There's no way to pull them apart. So even though we're having a Dhamma talk tonight about aversion, we have to first begin to understand that they're all interrelated to each other. And the energy level of sloth and torpor and restlessness, doubt, they're all intertwined. I would go so far as to say it's all the exact same thing. There's no real difference between aversion or doubt or sloth and torpor or greed or any of that. It's all the same, even the restlessness. It's just the lens that we're looking at it through. So I could not see the aversion because I wasn't looking through this lens of aversion. I didn't think for the bulk of the time that I was having any hindrances. I just thought something was wrong with the practice. I must have to tweak it a little bit, do something, just a little, to get it the way it's supposed to go, and then we're good. That's hindrance. That's what it is. It's that needing to tweak the moment, to tweak it just a little bit, to get it to kind of fit in there the way it's supposed to be. And what we never challenge is the thinking that this is the way it's supposed to be. We don't challenge the notion that maybe our thinking, whatever we think it should be like, is the problem. And that is how the hindrances kind of sneak in. So if we're going to do this practice with it, if we're going to begin to delve into these hindrances, then we got to have four pillars that we're kind of willing to hold up through the whole 5 months. We can't take it personal. It's sort of this understanding that this is not about me. In fact, the deeper your practice gets, the more you're going to see. The more subtler you're going to see it, the more habitual it gets. So this habitual nature of it means that you can't just stop it when you want to stop it. You see something and you're like, oh, I don't like that about something I'm doing. You can't just stop it. It's the seeing of that habitual kind of way in which the mind operates. Being able to not take it personal so we can see the arising and how it shows up, whatever that hindrance is going to support us in the long run in being able to be awakened. We can't actually awaken until we're able to be with the hindrances at a level that we don't get caught in it. And we'll get caught as long as we think this hindrance says something about me. Even if we don't want to get caught, we will. And I'm hoping you can see that my thinking, I needed to tweak my practice a little bit so we'll get it back on track, is taking it personal. I'm somehow thinking that I am the one that's going to make my practice go the way it's good, the best way. So, which goes to the second thing, is we have to promise to let go of any kind of self-evaluations about our practice over the next 5 months. It's actually wanting to see, if we want to see aversion, if we want to get up close to aversion, if we want to get up close to greed or any of these hindrances, we can't evaluate what we see as some kind of, we can't make a self-evaluation about how we're doing. And if we catch ourselves kind of making that self-evaluation, we'll begin to see how we can kind of fall into the trap of attachment and the entanglement of it. I did not see that until it was about maybe 3 weeks in. So I guess it wasn't the full 6 weeks that I was lost in this hindrance. It was about 3 weeks in. One of the teachers was giving this Dhamma talk. So I had these little thoughts that would show up, like, I don't think you're still enough yet to worry. And I'd be like, oh, that's okay. Don't think about that. Or, what if your mind can't really get as still as you think it is? Maybe now that you don't have any striving, you can't do it. Ah, go away. Not listening to that. All these little thoughts would just pop up in the head. And they were little, just a little phrase. Flicking away. You know, I'm a strong practitioner. That stuff doesn't mean anything to me. And I just toss it away. These little things, little words that come in. That word is doubt. And I knew that phrase as doubt. But I'm just batting it all away. Not even listening. It's not even important. And then about 3 weeks in, I'm at this Dhamma talk, sitting there listening. Here comes that one phrase about, oh, what if you can't do this? What if your mind's not as good as you think it is? Oh, and it would snatch. I'm trying to bat all these little things away, listening to the Dhamma talk, and before you know it, it's clumping on me. And I could feel myself growing in this sense of overwhelming doubt. Is like total failure. So you're just like growing in this sense of failure. Nothing's gonna work. I gotta get out of this place. I gotta come up with some way to get out of here because there's no way I can do the next 9 weeks. Yes, I just can't do it. I can't do it. And by the end of the Dhamma talk, I was sitting in this full-on state of just like, it's not so much the old self-loathing I used to have as much as it was, I hate this place, I hate this retreat, I hate all this, I shouldn't have spent all that money. It's probably because that teacher, I hate him, I hate everybody. Hate, 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 hate. It's just all over the place. The only thing that saved me was I gave up my phone in order to like settle into this retreat and take it serious. And I could not remember a family member's phone number for the life of me. I wrote them down and tried to remember. I could not remember a phone number. So the plan was to just go back to my room, get the phone number, give it, go down and make a phone call and say, call tomorrow and tell them, I gotta go home. It's an emergency. Sorry. But since I could not remember anybody's phone number, I could not do that. And that night, it's like the mind was operating on some kind of a vortex to make me, I was stuck in this aversion of hating everything about it, and I felt it. I felt it, not thought it. I felt it. I felt the pain of not liking, not wanting. This isn't right. Something's wrong. I felt that. And when I felt it, I woke up in the middle of the night and said, yeah, this is not true. Something's wrong. So I went to the hall and I sat there and said, we're just going to sit here until we're calmed down. No more, you know, no more trying to make it right. Doesn't matter what happens. We're going to be fine. And after that night, I was okay. I learned some things, though. So if it weren't for that doubt, that aversion that was showing up, I wouldn't have known that what was actually happening to me is that in the midst of a retreat, my whole identity was changing. So, you guys know I was a lawyer. And what do lawyers do? We strive. And the better you strive, the more successful you are. I was a good trial lawyer because I could win and I was all about winning all the time. And so this striving to win became part of who I was. I mean, I went through law school and it is like churned into your head that you have to strive. I spent 25 years as a prosecutor. Just college alone is about striving. So my whole world was striving. So you can imagine that first interview, when I made that commitment not to strive, everything in the world was going to go topsy-turvy because I don't know any other way of being except to strive. And when I decided not to strive, everything became turned upside down. When I began to see the hindrance, this aversion, this wanting, this doubt, all of those hindrances mushed together as a sign that I was not doing what I habitually do, not wrong, just not habit, then they begin to help me, free me up to help me see and have this, you know, amazing kind of experience, right? So it's actually the work that we do with the hindrances that frees us into the seven factors of awakening that we're going to get to. If we don't have the willingness to get in there in a relationship with the hindrances, we're going to keep trying to bat it away, but we're not actually going to do the work that allows for awakening to happen. So if we're going to get in here and do that work, can't take it personal, can't get stuck in that self-evaluation, can't get stuck in the idea that something's wrong with me if the hindrances are present. All it's really saying is that we're human. And we got to take them seriously. We got to take that those little words that we hear, those little phrasing that we just kind of push away and don't pay any attention to. We got to start looking at that stuff and watching how we're talking to ourselves, the tension that's in the body and things that are happening. So I have a couple more things I want to say about working with these hindrances generally. First is, there's two ways I begin to notice how this aversion is showing up in my retreat. There's a gross level, which is very reactive. And we know that level because that's the level that we see. It's so obvious. We see the pain and the anguish that comes with it, and we get very reactive. So my wanting to blame my teacher, getting mad at my sits, getting irritated with everything that's going on because it's not working. I was sad, disappointed. All of that energy, all that emotional energy, all that unpleasantness, that I don't want it to be like this energy, is the grosser reactivity. It's the part of us that begins to push away the unpleasantness. We are resisting reality. And so that resisting a reality and a way to begin to see that is that reactivity, that pushing that we can see so obviously, that's based in a distortion. So there are four of them. We either think something should be permanent and it's not, or we are thinking something is permanent and now we're finding out that it's not permanent. So we're having this push against reality and we react to it on this grosser level. Or we're thinking something, we kind of bet, I guess you could say we put our basket, all our eggs in one basket, thinking, relying on something to satisfy us, and it's not happening. So here a way to think about it is, I thought that the way I had been practicing is the right way, and so if it's not acting like that, that's the wrong way. Rather than just accepting whatever was showing up as practice. Instead, I'm trying to make my practice fit in what I think it should be. And I think it should be what it always has been. That's how I know I'm doing good. Or I relied upon this silencing of that sound as my way of letting me know that everything's okay. So when the sound doesn't silence, now I'm going to push against that. I don't like that, because it's not working the way it's supposed to and something's going wrong. We can take it personal, make it personal when it's really not personal. My mind, that sound, my sits had nothing to do with me. It's not like the mind was like, oh, we're going to set Tuareg up this time. She thinks she's going to go this way, but we're going to go that way. It's not like that at all in reality. But yet, I was getting disappointed. I have to tell you this one story. So I'm sitting here feeling disappointed. This is like 2 weeks in. I'm like, I can't believe it. It's 2 weeks in. I should be steady. I should be concentrated. I'm sitting there at some meal. I think it was breakfast. And if you've ever been to IMS, right outside the windows of the dining hall is this enormous tree. There's a couple of them, but one of them is this enormous tree. Right, you just look out the window and it's right there in front of you. So I'm looking out the window, and the weather earlier had been warm and sunny, but on this morning or this day, it's cold. And I'm looking at this tree, imagining this tree bending over like, oh, it's so cold, I hate it, I wish it wasn't so cold here. It's sort of like that, like a tree. We don't expect a tree to get disappointed because it's cold or not warm or it's too hot But that's what we do to ourselves. We have these emotional tendencies that we treat ourselves like whatever emotion we have is the truth of the experience. And it's the only thing of the experience. So I'm sitting here realizing it doesn't make any sense that I'm so disappointed about something I don't have any control over. But the trick is with the hindrances, if you're trying to not be disappointed, rather than looking and investigating where is that disappointment coming from? What is that? Then you get stuck in the trap of trying to not be disappointed, which means you have to figure out a way to fix the outer world so I won't be disappointed. Can you understand that? Can you hear that? It's like you're trying not to be what you are because you think I shouldn't be disappointed. But therein lies this obscuring nature of a hindrance, and that's aversion. That's a pushing away something that's present because you think it shouldn't be present. And there's this resistance to it. On the gross level, that's what we're doing. On the subtle level, there's another level of these hindrances, which is this much more subtle level. That's the felt sense that we're trying to get to. That's the subtle level of practicing with the hindrances is where we are connected to the possibility or the potential to awaken. It's in the body, not in the mind. In the gross level, you're watching what your mind is saying and paying attention to the mental distortions that are going on. On this subtler level with these hindrances, you're trying to see what's the felt sense into this. And that's a little different. I think that has more to do with the self. But first I have this quote I want to read about Stephen Levine that I really like this. He says, the demons aren't the noise. They are the aversion to the noise. When you can accept discomfort, doing so allows a balance of mind. That surrender, that letting go of wanting anything to be other than it is right in the moment is what frees us from the hell. So there's a kind of way in which we have to notice the mind's grumbling, the mind's pushing against whatever's happening, its resistance to reality, that helps us begin to move from the grosser level to the subtler level. But when we start moving to the subtler level, then we're going to start feeling some discomfort. And that's the reason why we are, you know, impulsively reacting in the first place. So a way to think about this subtler level is that you're actually seeing the nature of the self and the nature of the way the body and mind create self, the way it generates an identity of who we are. So the way I broke this up is you could see the nature of the rising self versus the stillness of simply being with something. Right? There's a stillness that comes with just being with something, just for a moment, just to check it out. But the reason why we can't be still is because the self rises and says, this is uncomfortable, we need to fix this, tweak it a little bit, make it much better. That's all we got to do is just make it much better, and then we won't feel uncomfortable. That subtler distinction, you're going to feel that in the body. Another way you could think of it is you could notice the body contracting. There's that felt sense of the body contracting against something, pulling back or pushing against, versus this kind of contentment that comes when we don't judge something. The only reason why there's a contraction is because we're judging something as either good or bad, right or wrong, correct or not correct. And when we have this contentment in this non-judgment, then we can begin to experience the moment more clearly the way it is. We can see more clearly. And the third way I thought was a way you could think of it is in the aversion or in the hindrance when we're pushing against something, it's the grasping mind that's automatically taking hold of something versus in the subtle body, there's a joy with just acceptance. There's a subtle bliss or pleasure when we just let something be and begin to notice it without the pushing on it. So the gross level, we're kind of thinking about the mind, watching what we're doing, and on these subtler levels of dealing with these hindrances, we're really trying to feel it. And so you can see that if you're having a lot of reactivity, pushing up against something because you don't like it, then our ability to be in this subtler place of just feeling the discomfort or feeling the contraction or feeling that I don't like gets harder to do. It's learning to balance the mind. It's like this balancing of the mind is how we, I guess I shouldn't say just the mind, it's the balancing of the mind and body. This is how you start working with it. You start getting used to that discomfort, getting used to that reactivity, getting used to feeling that, and then balancing that with right thought. Those right intentions that we talked about in the Four Noble Truths. You can see that the suffering, whatever that suffering is actually the first step towards awakening. You gotta feel the discomfort of it. Instead of, in the beginning, you might just see your reactivity, but at some point you're gonna drop down in the body and feel the discomfort. And when you feel that discomfort, you're in the first noble truth. You're noticing that there is suffering. That's the only way you're gonna be able to turn into that hindrance or turn into your own sort of thinking and begin to question and look into your view, the thoughts that are going on. So we just balance that seeing against the right thought, right intention. Sharon Salzberg, I like this quote, says, if we turn away from our own pain, we might find ourselves projecting this aversion onto others, seeing them as somehow inadequate for being in a troubled situation. So that's what that reactivity is. On this grosser level of dealing with the aversion or desire, we are basically taking our own discomfort and pushing it outside of us onto something else, pushing it onto the situation, pushing it onto another person. We're pushing our discomfort onto something outside of us, thinking wrongly that if I change the environment, fix the circumstances around me, I won't have any discomfort. And that is so automatic. It's so connected to the human tendencies that Tim was talking about, our natural human tendencies toward greed, hatred, and delusion. That is the mind's natural selfing mechanism. Instead, we want to balance this against the right thought, which is the path of basically saying, in all situations, I'm going to use restraint, I'm not going to harm, and I'm gonna try to apply some level of kindness, right? So it doesn't matter what the situation is, these right thoughts of non-harming, goodwill, or I just feel comfortable with kindness, and renunciation, that is the kind of practice that we are constantly employing to balance this natural tendency towards pushing away what we don't like. I like this quote by Pema Chodron. It says, rather than going after our walls and barriers with a sledgehammer, we pay attention to them with gentleness and honesty. We move closer to those walls. We touch them and smell them and get to know them well. We begin a process of acknowledging our aversions and our cravings. We become familiar with the strategies and beliefs we use to build the walls. What are the stories I tell myself? What repels me and what attracts me? We just start to get curious about what's going on. That curiosity is like sunshine in fog. It like actually begins to burn off the elusiveness, the kind of haziness of the hindrances, and you can actually see them truly for what they are. You could actually be grateful. I mean, I can remember realizing, when I realized that all of my not liking my sits the way they were was actually helping me not get stuck in trying to do some habit around how to sit. And I'm glad I did, because I changed, oh my God, it was a completely different world of practice. Okay, so I probably should stop. I could talk forever, so I'm actually gonna think about stopping here. There's one more thing I want to say. Joseph Goldstein said, he said that the word for aversion, the Pali word is pataka. I think it's pronounced pataka. But what it means is striking against, right? So if you think about it, whenever we don't like something, what we're actually doing is hitting it. Like, go away, go away. Not anger. That's why I want to make sure we put anger in a completely different category. Even if we are not even... So I'm in a silent retreat. I'm not talking to anybody. We're all very quiet. We all look very peaceful, very loving. People were saying, oh, Tori, you just look so peaceful sitting back there. I was like smacking myself all over the place, right? Hitting, hitting, hitting. Like, get this right, get this right. What are you doing? That's what we're doing. We just keep hitting, 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 hitting. If we saw children hitting each other, we would say, stop that, don't hit. But yet, that's what that resistance is. We're hitting reality and trying to make it go away. This constant hitting, hitting, hitting. That's what we want to see. We want to see ourselves hitting reality. And that is not going to be easy to do. That is not going to be something we're going to want to see. In fact, it's going to be something we don't want to see. So the hindrances, if you hold it as a obstacle, a problem, something I gotta get rid of so I'm not doing it, then your relationship with it is gonna be the opposite of awakening. Instead, it's an intimate relationship. It's like this loving, kind, I got it. It is the way you have to be with a two-year-old who's throwing a tantrum. It's not that you know this two-year-old is not trying to just be mean to you, hate you, do something wrong. In that moment, your mind is throwing a tantrum. The ego is throwing a tantrum. And if you push up against it with a sledgehammer, hitting at it, it'll just keep throwing the tantrum, pushing back. Instead, there's a way in which we're going to talk next week about using metta, kindness, these three right thoughts to help change our understanding around what's going on. Adishanti said that ego is the movement of the mind towards objects of perception in the form of grasping and away from objects in the form of aversion. This fundamentally is all the ego is. The movement of grasping and aversion gives rise to a sense of a separate me, and in turn, a sense of me strengthens itself this way. So the more we push and push and hit and try to make these things go away, these habits that we don't like, these behaviors that as a meditator, I can't believe that, I don't get angry. No, not angry. I don't get upset. I don't have that aversion. All of that stuff that we don't want to see in ourselves, if we're going to awaken, we are going to have to see it. All the ugly stuff, all the stuff that we want to believe is not us, that's what we're going to have to see. So to do that, maybe I'll end with this quote from Mary Oliver as a way to understand how we're going to do it in honor of her death. Such a sad thing. But now we'll be reading Mary Oliver poems all the time. This is one of my favorite ones. So we'll just end with this. Why the wasp was on my bed, I didn't know. Why I was in bed, I did know. Why there wasn't room for both of us, I didn't know. I watched it idly. Idleness can be a form of dying. I did know that. The wasp didn't communicate how it felt. It did look confused on the white sheet, as though it had landed somewhere in the Arctic. And it did flick its wings when I raised my legs, causing an upheaval. I didn't want to be lying there. I didn't want to go in that direction. And so I say it was a gift. When it rose into the air and, as wasps do, expressed itself in a sudden and well-aimed motion. Almost delicious was its deep, inflexible sting. Let's just sit a moment. Okay. Well, let's just see if there's any comments or questions anybody has. Hope I'm not the only one who's got to work with aversion. Somehow I think I'm not, but
Yeah.
Thank you for your teaching. I remember reading something in maybe it was Tricycle Magazine, one of those a while ago. It was from a Tibetan perspective. But the idea was that if you come across someone who you find to be unpleasant, you're really bothered. They're really, gosh, so irritated at them. That the lesson was to thank them for being a hidden jewel.
Yeah. That's actually, so for the recording, the comment was that they read somewhere, they think it was Tibetan, that if you come across someone that's really irritating you or really bothering you a lot, that you actually thank them as a hidden jewel. That's one of their, it's one that's in their Lojan practice. But it's also, I think the word is Dhammapala. It's the idea that, let's say you believe that your path is around patience. You want to develop a sense of patience. In order to do that, you need to be in a lot of impatient situations so that you could practice patience. So every situation that brings impatience to you, you should actually be giving it a gratitude for keeping you on the path. And that is a lot of the way I'm talking about the hindrances. It's just that way. Like they are the actual aspect that keeps us moving towards awakening. Or they can be if we don't get caught in them, as opposed to if we don't get too entangled with them or personal with them. Yeah?
My first response to hearing this was like, I had to really work through that because I had this ideal in my mind about what a truly awakened person was. Patient. And for me, it's paradoxical because there are times when I can appreciate the teaching and the jewel, but I have to say no because I also have to speak the truth if someone is emotionally or verbally abusing me or mistreating me.
It's really good that you're saying that because that's actually the truth of the way the practice lines up. But the comment is that, I'll see if I can paraphrase it, that just hearing this idea that I come to work with impatience and someone is really irritating me, to just thank them or, have some kind of gratitude for them creates... Just, I don't know, I guess what you're saying is it seems like it goes against, or that you're being too passive. Like sometimes you have to stand up and say no, and you have to, protect yourself from someone that's abusing you or just being mean or difficult. Yes.
If I do it from truth, it might be angry, it might be happy, it might be sad, it might be anything in that moment. But if it's true and not based on an ideal, then that to me is
Yeah, I like that. So the follow-up then would be, if your reactions is based on an ideal of what you think you should be acting like and not based on the truth of how the moment is, then you are, then somehow it feels like it's not authentic, it's not being real. That, so in the situations you're describing, there are two aspects that are going on. There is a relative reality that we all live in, and there is a universal reality that we all live in. And so there's a way in which our practice is helping us walk in both of those worlds. So I don't know, I can't remember the quote or the story fully, but there's a story in which the Buddha, somebody came in and said something derogatory or was actually kind of being abusive in the Sangha that he was teaching at. And I had this idea that the Buddha was like a, whenever he spoke, flowers, petals would fall from his lips, you know, and everything was all beautiful. But when I was in the teacher training, one of the retreats, that they gave us this sutta to read. And Buddha was like running this man down. Just like, I could not believe the way he was talking to this person. Because it seemed so wrong to say it like that. Like snapping at him and basically saying, you know, You just of no value here. You need to go. But the teachers were saying that the first of all, to hold this ideal, like you're saying, of what a good practitioner is supposed to look like, that's the problem. In reality, when somebody is giving gratitude to the person that's triggering their impatience, they're not giving gratitude for the conduct. They're giving gratitude that it was enough to wake me up and help me see that I need to come back to the present moment and do something. That's what you're giving gratitude for. So when Buddha was snapping at this person, he was protecting the larger Sangha and what this person was actually bringing into it. And that person needed to leave for the, it's like a wake-up call to the rest of the Sangha members that this guy was really over the top. But it completely destroyed our view about how we see the Buddha, like always petals flowing from his lips. If he said something, everybody's awakened. I just never would have thought of him as yelling at someone. But clearly he yelled at people. I mean, he was a regular person, sad and all the rest of the emotions. So, but he did not, it was the aversion that he did not have. That's the part of him that was plucked away. So if you're talking about, if somebody abuses me or if somebody is being mean to me, and I'm going to push back at them out of aversion, like, I don't like that, so you stop that and you go away. There, we're moving into harming ourselves as much as we might be harming someone else. Instead, we want to see, can we do what we need to do, like respond by saying no, or that's unacceptable, or I'm not going to do that, without having the aversion of not liking, the ill will of I don't like, I don't like, I don't like, I don't want, I don't want. That's the problem. And since we're talking about emotions, that's the reason why I'm separating that, because that's what we're going to talk about next week. More on this emotional energy that we get intertwined with, not just the basic, I don't like the way a situation is. Good. You think it's time to stop? I do too. Matt's like, yes, it is time to stop. I think so too. So next week, we're going to talk about the emotional side of aversion. And, you know, some ways in which we can actually, there are many tools to help us, skillful means actually, to help us be with aversion in a relationship that's actually supportive and not, there's a way to be with the aversion without pushing. That's what we're trying to do. See the hindrances without trying to push or strike against or resist reality.